Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Legacy Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. We're getting some snow outside again today, so I see we have a quorum. So, Representative Lee, have you had an opportunity to peek at our minutes? And if so, would you be willing to move them?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes for January 11th.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Any questions in regards to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you. We have the minutes. Thank you, Representative Lee. Well, good morning, again, committee. So we have many different groups that get funds. So we've invited some of the different groups today to come today and visit, and we can do a deeper dive into some of our funds, and they can tell the story. This will not be their presentation of what for what they're asking for this session, so we're hoping to dig in a little deeper and what they're doing with the money, what they've done with the money, and then give members an opportunity to ask questions, because historically, especially in the last few years, these particular areas have been very, very important to the committee members, and a deep focus has kind of been on what the funds are going towards and how they're being spent in these areas. And I think today we have great testifiers, and they can tell us these stories, and we're trying to allow time for questions. So don't be shy. I think we'll have them do their presentations, and then we'll do questions on each area, and then move on to the next one, and maybe even have time to have them back if that's the case. So with that, I'd like to ask Ms. Gents to come forward, come on up, and tell us about the work that the Minnesota State Arts Board is doing. Welcome back to Legacy. Go ahead when you're ready, please.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to be back. It's nice to be back here in person and see all of you and meet many new members of the committee. I am Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and I really appreciate having a little bit of time today just to give you a high-level overview of our agency. I refer to this as a tip of the iceberg presentation. So, with deference to my historical society colleagues, I'm going to start with a little bit of history. Minnesota was the second state in the country to establish an agency within state government to promote and strengthen the arts. You might think that we did that in the 1960s or 70s. In fact, the Minnesota legislature did it in 1903. For more than a century, the state of Minnesota has, through its state arts agency, been investing in the arts. Our mission, our structure, and our responsibilities are in state statute. It's Chapter 129, D01 through D05, just five little sections. Our mission statement is here on the screen, and you have it in your handout. It's very broad, and that's appropriate, because in the arts, one size does not fit all. One person might love opera, another person might love watercolors, or might love spoken word. A father might like to spend an afternoon at a museum with his children. A grandmother might like to be part of a quilting circle or pass on the traditions of weaving or beadwork to her grandchildren. Our work is motivated by the idea that we want all Minnesotans to have access to the kinds of arts experiences that are meaningful to them. Our structure is also in state statute. We have 11 members who are appointed by the governor. They come from all over the state. We must have one member from each of the 8 congressional districts, and we have a link to our board list online if you'd like to read about their backgrounds. We have a staff of 22 FTE, and we have advisors. Our statute allows and directs us to bring advisors into our process. Each year, more than 300 individuals come into our work. They contribute their experiences and their perspectives in our grant-making process, and I will talk about that just a little bit later on. Oops, I'm going the wrong way. I told you I'd have trouble with the technology. State statute also outlines the duties and the authority that we have, and there are a number of them, but I've picked the four key ones and put them on the slide for you again in your handout. And I want to focus on two that really receive the greatest attention and focus of our work. The first one is the first bullet. Our primary activity is to provide financial support to strengthen, to build, and to develop the arts all across the state of Minnesota. We do that through grants primarily, and we also do it through other kinds of capacity building or technical assistance services. Unlike my colleagues who will be presenting today from the Historical Society and the Humanities Center, we don't produce arts activities. We don't run an arts venue. We don't offer art making classes. We don't need to do that. There are hundreds, in fact, thousands of artists and arts organizations that can do that. Our piece of the infrastructure is to help them do that work as well as they can through financial support and through other kinds of assistance we can provide them. The third bullet is another important of our duties. We're the fiscal agent passing through state dollars to a system of regional arts councils. And I'll say just a bit more about regional arts councils. Again, we were one of the first states in the country to establish this sort of a two-tiered structure where there is a state agency and then there is also a second, more regional set of organizations that use state dollars to invest in the arts in their areas. Regional arts councils are not satellite offices of the Arts Board. They're independent nonprofit organizations. They have local decision-making. They decide what the needs are in their part of the state. They decide how best to use state dollars. As fiscal agent, it's our job to review their biennial plans, to approve those, to get reports from them, and then to monitor and reconcile how they're spending state dollars. Shortly after the legacy amendment was passed, the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils together developed what we call our 25-year arts framework. It articulates our vision and goals, and it also outlines how we might invest funds. And this screen includes the most important part of that framework, which are the goals that we're trying to achieve. And you might notice that what we're really focusing on is how funds impact Minnesotans and what benefit might Minnesotans get from the activities that we're going to invest in. I have two very quick slides about the dollars. I know this is not the budget presentation, but I wanted to give you a sense of scope just so you'll understand better the work we're doing. I'd mentioned that we have a decades-long tradition of serving as the state's arts agency. We've been receiving general fund dollars for decades. On this slide, the green bars are the general fund dollars. In the 2008-2009 biennium, we were receiving about $20 million from the state general fund. 2010, you can see a big change. When the legacy amendment started, it's been a significant increase in funding for us, but really what that has allowed us to do is to significantly increase the impact of the service that we can provide. This is how those state funds are expended. The green slice is the dollars that are appropriated or passed through to the Regional Arts Council in the form of block grants. It's about 30% of the funds. The yellow slice are the dollars that we distribute through our statewide grant programs. And the little gray slice at the top is the amount of money that we're using for grants administration, personnel, and operating costs. One of the things that I think is remarkable about our work is that 95% of the state dollars we receive from the legislature leave our office in the form of a grant. So I talked about grant making. That really is our primary activity. It's why we were created as a state system. This gives you a snapshot of the volume of work. I wish I could come in and talk to you about every single grantee and every single project that we fund. That would not be possible. There just are too many of them. But you'll see the past 3 years that we as a system have been reviewing well over 3,000, close to 4,000 grant applications. And we have been awarding more than 2,500, 2,800, close to 3,000 grants. I don't have fiscal 23 for you yet. We're still in our fiscal 23 grant cycle, so we're not finished for the year. But I mentioned advisors earlier. They play a key role because they're the ones who read all of the grant applications. They're the ones who discuss them in a public meeting. They score them. And then based on those scores, we decide which of the applications we're going to fund. We think this citizen-driven, inclusive process where Minnesotans are deciding how their arts dollars are going to be spent is really one of our key strengths. wanted to talk just a little bit about those grant programs and who they're funding and how they're doing that. So many of you know that COVID-19 had a profound impact on our state, on our society. It also had a profound impact on the creative community. Artists and arts organizations lost work, lost their income, lost their opportunities overnight. To meet the moment, we decided that we couldn't just continue business as usual, so we condensed what had been 10 grant programs down into 3. We continued to offer an operating support program, which we have been offering since the 1990s, and that really is ongoing mission-driven support for many of the most prominent arts organizations all across the state of Minnesota, many of them in your districts, a Center for the Arts in Fergus Falls, the Lakes Area Music Festival in Brainerd, Hopewell Music Cooperative that Representative Lee talked about a few days ago, Two Dance, Grand Center in New Ulm, Great River Shakespeare Festival, Juxtaposition Arts, and others. It's about 190 organizations that we're funding through that program. The creative support programs were really our COVID relief programs. We wanted artists and arts organizations to have some funding to figure out how they were going to operate in the COVID environment when they couldn't do the work the way they had before. And so in most cases, what they did is try to find out, could they do things virtually? Could they do outdoor activities? Could they do other kinds of things that didn't require people to be in a physical space together? And so I'll give you just a few examples of those. Many of those creative support for organizations grants were used either for outdoor activities or for online activities. The Ely Art Walk, the Selby Avenue Jazz Festival, and others, big outdoor celebrations where people could still come together and celebrate the arts. The Ekiman Prairie Lodge in Brooklyn Center is a senior facility, and they figured out a way to safely bring in artists to work with their senior populations who were feeling so isolated during the years of COVID. In the individuals program, same sort of thing. Individual artists are trying to figure out how to make their work available through technology. A dancer in St. Paul named Yan Pang, she choreographed work for people who are differently abled, and then she videoed that work so that it could be shown to family and friends and to other audiences who might like to see that kind of a dance performance. Emily Durkee from Grand Marais is a basket maker, and in order to sell her baskets and pass on her trade as a willow and birch bark basket maker, she started offering workshops online so that other people could learn that skill. The regional arts councils together offer more than 100 grant programs. They wouldn't all fit on a slide, so instead I've given you some broad categories of the kinds of grants that they offer. Just a reminder, their job is to build up the arts economy in their own communities and in their own region. So what might be important in northwest Minnesota might not be relevant in southeastern Minnesota. So each of their councils is doing different things. Again, I'll share just a couple of examples of some of the Regional Arts Council grants from the last few years. Here in the Twin Cities, the Asian Economic Development Association sponsors something called Little Mekong Night Market, and the Regional Arts Council here in the Twin Cities has been providing some support for that activity. True Arts Speaks is a spoken word and hip-hop organization that works with young people. They have been funded by their Regional Arts Council. In Greater Minnesota, a couple examples again from your districts. The city of Pelican Rapids received money to hire artists to coordinate a community mural to celebrate the people and the history and the legacy of Pelican Rapids. And in Montgomery, the Arts and Heritage Center hired artists to put art in storefronts, in windows, because, again, people couldn't come into a building. And so these art exhibits also highlighted what's special and important about that part of the state. They talked about farmers and the history of agriculture, and they talked about the veterans and the tradition of service in that community. I've shared many numbers with you today. I will end with what I think is the most important number. In the last biennium, more than 19 million people participated in a program that was supported by an arts board or a regional arts council grant. Even during COVID, people wanted to be involved in the arts, and they found ways to do that, whether it was safely indoors, whether it was outside, or whether it was online. Those programs helped preserve our cultural arts traditions. They gave people creativity and inspiration during a dark time. They helped them develop their own creative talents and skills. We know from some recent research that 91% of Minnesotans said they used the arts to improve their physical or mental health. And most importantly, they build connections to one another. They spend time with their neighbors, with their family, in their community. So on behalf of those 19 million people, I would say thank you for the past support, and thank you for your time today. With that, Mr. Chair, I will stop, and I will be happy to respond to questions if you have them.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Gents, and I think we are going to have some questions. I just have a real quick one that you can throw out. So I was lucky enough to go see, for example, like Beauty of the Beast at the Ordway, and they had the Legacy logo, cultural. And then I was, I think, the White Bear Theater. So, and there was a play that we went to there and ahead of the Legacy. So what involvement would that be, or would that just vary? Did you fully, or not fully, but majorly sponsor like the Beauty and Beast at Ordway, or is it just general support for the Ordway, or how does that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to guess that in those two instances that you mentioned, those were probably operating support grantees. We fund the Ordway through our operating support program, and we also mm-hmm. fund, you said, was it Lakeshore Players in White Bear Lake? So that's another operating support grantee. And so we're providing general support for those organizations to invest in whatever their highest priorities are. They might put that into their regular performance series. They might put that into their education or outreach programs, or they might use it for other things that are mission-driven. But, yes, we are funding both of those organizations through that program.
Representative Finke, Representative Hurt after that.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I'm just curious if you can just for scale's sake, if you can talk a little bit about, you know, how small are the smallest grants and how big are the biggest grants that you award?
Sure.
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Representative Finke, for that question. It varies by the programs. So in the Creative Support for Individuals program that I mentioned, the largest grant we award is $10,000, and generally the smallest is about $5,000. In Creative Support for Organizations, this year the largest grant we will award is $30,000, and I think the smallest so far is maybe $6,000 or $7,000. In the Operating Support Program, those range from $15,000 all the way up to $1 million. So that one has the widest variance. In the two Creative Support Programs, and in fact in all of our project programs, the one of the things that is really important is that oftentimes when you're applying for funds from a private funder, you might have to kind of guess what they might give you. So you ask high, thinking maybe you'll get half, we'll ask for 40, hoping we get 20, we'll ask for 10, hoping we get 5. That hasn't been the Arts Board's process. We will fully fund all of the applications that are highly ranked until we run out of money. And we don't give partial awards until we have run out of funds. You know, we don't want to have organizations count on money and then have to second guess or change their projects or programs because we're giving them less. So we will award what they ask for.
Representative Finke.
Thank you. That's great to hear. And I have worked professionally in the arts as well as I'm a person who I'm an artist. I work. It's very important to me. And it's important to me to recognize how valuable just a little bit of money can be in this space where money is so difficult to achieve. So I'm really grateful for the work you do. Excited to support that.
Thank you. Representative Hurt.
Thank you, Chair Lilly, and thank you for the presentation, Ms. Jens. Just a couple of quick questions here. So the regional arts councils are independent orgs. So just curious as to like the oversight that you might have over them to really see how they're using their grant dollars versus what you're doing, just if you could talk a little bit to that.
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burr, thank you so much for that question. We're very careful in our relationship with the regional arts councils. We don't micromanage them. Mm-hmm. We don't tell them which programs or services to offer. We really want them to decide what's most valuable to their citizens. They do give us a very detailed biennial plan. In fact, those plans are going to be coming in just a couple of months. We have a committee that we set up to review those plans. We ask questions about their priorities. We ask questions about their needs assessment and how they determine which programs they wanted to offer. Once those plans are approved, then the regional arts councils are responsible for managing those funds. They do provide final reports. We do monitor them. We meet with them during the grant periods and monitor what they're doing. and we have to reconcile those grants. So they provide receipts, they provide evidence of how they have spent the funds, they provide their audits to us. And we actually talk to the Regional Arts Councils quite often. Just, you know, we have a strong relationship with all of them. So they are autonomous, but they understand that although they are not required to follow the state's grants management policies, that with state funds come state requirements, and they're expected to behave as though they are state agencies using the funds in the same way we might.
Thank you. Just a couple.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. So my follow-up question to that is then how do you ensure that, I guess, can an individual or an organization asking for a grant potentially get two grants, one from you and then one as well from one of the Regional Arts Council? Or do you sort of say you get one pot of the funds?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Herr. We don't have a restriction that says you can only be funded by a Regional Arts Council or by the Arts Board. Okay. In fact, what we do is we encourage individuals or organizations to apply anywhere there might be an opportunity, because applying doesn't guarantee that you'll receive a grant.
Sure.
It's been a little different since COVID, just because some activities have ceased or some entities have taken a bit of a hiatus. But before the COVID pandemic happened, we were only able to fund about 40% of the applications we received. Regional Arts Councils were funding 60 to 70% of their applications. So we do encourage individuals and organizations to look for any of the opportunities that might be open to them.
Just one last question, Chair Lilly.
It's all right. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lilly.
Today,
Ms. Jens, just one last question. On your page 10, when you looked at the breakout between the Arts Board Grants Program, we don't do it here, if you could just maybe get us some extra data. I want to see the breakout of the funds between the three different areas, like what percentage, like how much goes to the operating support versus creative support organizations versus that third category. And then if you have that now, that would be great. But the other question I have is, I think you had mentioned there was 170 orgs that you support in operating support. And I would love to see the breakdown between large nonprofits that you might be supporting, or large organizations versus smaller ones, because I do know that I'm very much tied to the arts community as well. I'm a closet artist, and so I really support public art, and support a public dollars to arts. But I do see that smaller organizations struggle quite a bit, and their ability to get funding, and the way we do philanthropy is that we don't want to take risk on dollars to organizations we think aren't proven, right? But a lot of artists start very small, and very few get to ever be in that stage in which they're going to be looked at as a stable artist or a stable organization. So I would love to actually see more data on the size of organizations that we support, because we know that a lot of the innovative work that addresses the disparities that we see within society, which art oftentimes talks to, usually come from smaller artists. And so if you could maybe touch a little bit on that, and if there's more data you could provide later just for us to see that landscape, I'd greatly appreciate that.
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Herr, thank you for that question. Let me touch a little bit on the breakout of the funds between our three grant programs, because I think I can do that mostly from memory. Operating support is about 55% of our grant funds. Creative support for individuals is about 10%, 10 to 12% of the funds. And then I don't do math very well in my head. The remainder would go into the creative support for organizations, 35-ish. And that's, in some ways, it's based on the history of how many applications we've received from organizations versus individuals and those sorts of things. The other thing that I neglected to say, and I'm really sorry that I neglected to say it, and so thank you for the question. The operating support program is the only one that has a minimum budget size in order to apply.
Okay.
That's $174,000. We expect there is some kind of maybe staff and some ongoing programming activities, since those are more flexible dollars. We do expect a little bit more accountability for those kinds of funds. In the creative support for organizations, there is no lower budget size that you must have in order to qualify. That program is open to arts organizations. It's open to other nonprofits that have arts programming but are not primarily an arts organization. It's open to public entities. I mentioned the City of Pelican Rapids. That wasn't our grant, but those kinds of things. And we also fund fiscally sponsored projects in that program, exactly to your point about who has access to funds and how do especially newer, younger organizations get started and access funds. The other thing we did during COVID, and I'm sorry I neglected to say this, so I'll say it now for just a second. When we made our changes to those three grant programs, we also looked back at our history of who was applying and who was being funded. And we noticed disparities in three groups. One was applications from Greater Minnesota. One was applications from BIPOC individuals or BIPOC-led organizations. And the third was individuals with an identified disability or that exist to provide arts programming for people with disabilities. And so we've named those. We named those in our applications that these are priority groups. We've set up an allocation formula so that the percentage of grants those three groups will be equal to or greater than the percentage of applications that they submit. And so it really has had a good impact. It has brought more applications into our system, and we've been funding those grants at a higher level.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Ms. Gents. I was wondering if, kind of to that point, if you could provide to the committee the grants. I've seen some of the grant lists that you've done. If you could provide it maybe to Mike, and we could pass it, or to my committee administrator, and we could pass that to members, because I think it's really informative. Just a quick, so historically you've been able to overachieve, or not overachieve, but you've done quite well on, I thought, from my understanding, is you've been, for demographically, you've been able to do quite well with our minority members or community. Do you have a quick number off your head? Is it, I thought we had 40% of the grants were going to.
I do. I just have to flip back to my notes.
Quickly,
I've got it. So I will tell you what's happening this year in fiscal 23. In the Creative Support for Individuals program, for example, 43% of the applications we received came from Greater Minnesota, and 53% of the grants went to Greater Minnesota. BIPOC individuals, 32% of the applications came from BIPOC individuals, 44% of the grants. So if you think about the state and the state population, we're trying to get much closer and beyond parity in our investment in those. We're not finished with the grants for organizations yet. Right now, 36% of the applications came from Greater Minnesota, 41% of the grants. 24% of the applications came from BIPOC-led organizations, 33% of the grants, so a higher percentage in all cases. And as far as grant lists, I'm happy to provide those to Mr. Molzon to pass on to all of you. I will say that every grant that the Arts Board has awarded since 2002 is posted on our website. We have a section on our website called Grants Awarded, and you can look by year and by grant program, and you'll find an alpha list of all of those grants. But I'm happy to provide that in another format if it's easier for you to use.
Thank you. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Executive Director, I think you mentioned briefly about the scoring process. Can you elaborate more about that, you know, who is reviewing those grants and how are they being ranked, or what's the criteria when you're looking through these grants?
Ms. Jentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Vang, for that question. In each of the grant programs, we establish and we put in the application materials the review criteria we will use. And then there's a set of scores that can be assigned to each of the criteria. In operating support, there are five of them. It's artistic, it's governance and management, it's public engagement, public benefit, and evaluation and assessment. In the creative support programs, we're looking at the track record of providing arts experiences of any kind. We are looking at the quality or the kind of the thought process of how the proposal was put together and what the idea is, what the artist or the organization is setting out to do. And we ask them specifically to talk about the degree to which they are connected to and intend to serve underserved audiences. And we have them tell us who they think in their part of the state or in their community is underserved, and then they address that. The panels are those 300-plus advisors. It's about 350 advisors. They work in teams of about 7 to 10 people. They review 20 to 30 applications. They score them. And then we put all of those scores together, and the highest ranked are the ones that we recommend to our board for funding, using that allocation formula to give some priority to those three priority groups. And I'm happy to talk with you more about that. I know we're getting short on time, and I will be happy to visit with all of you individually to answer your questions.
Representative Bain. Representative Heitzman, and then Representative Lee, and then we probably have to wrap up. Representative Heitzman, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director I had a couple of questions. Representative Vang actually started to touch on where I wanted to go, and Director Jens, we've talked offline on a number of occasions, and we have a lot of new members here today that might have similar questions to what I've had in the past. So we're going through a little bit of the criteria and the process used to select projects that might succeed in achieving funding. Maybe you could walk the committee through some of the parameters, guardrails, shall we say, that are used when proposals come that many Minnesotans potentially could find offensive, and how you would handle those. What is the process to avoid those kind of situations?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, thank you so much for that question. The criteria that we use doesn't specify the kind of content that an individual or an organization could touch on in their grant programs. We do have requirements in our applications that say you cannot use Arts Board or Regional Arts Council funds for any activity that is not lawful. They cannot use the funds in a way that is illegal. But we see a wide variety of projects coming through with all sorts of different perspectives, all sorts of different ideas, all sorts of experiences. And one of the things that artists do, especially artists who are really serious about their craft, is they try to capture a moment, they try to capture an experience, they try to capture something that's happening in society, and they might comment on it. They might share their personal views on that, or they might share the views of people they've talked to. It's not uncommon that a project that we fund might appeal to some people and might not appeal to others, much like the laws that you pass here might appeal to some people and might not to others. And so in the breadth of our grant making, what we try to do, and you and I have talked about this, is that we try to provide enough variety in what we're funding so that every Minnesotan can find something, and we hope a number of things that they would be really happy about. And we know that sometimes art provokes strong emotions, provokes strong thoughts. Really what art asks us to do is to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, to think about maybe the world from their perspective or their life experience. And sometimes that's uncomfortable. And we know that some people wish we did not do that, but that is one of the things that art can do for us.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heitzman, go ahead. Quickly, we're over, and I really, I know that Ms. Jensen is certainly open to visiting, but go ahead.
I appreciate the discretion, Mr. Chair. This side of the table's only had one question so far, so I appreciate the second one. Director Jens, so what I was specifically asking was what were the parameters that the Art Council might use, or those that are involved in that process might our guidelines of sorts to help them avoid situations. There's all kinds of examples I could suggest, and I think that you and I could have a back and forth on that. But are there no parameters? Because I didn't specifically hear any.
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Heinzman. The parameters are that the applicant needs to describe the quality of the work that they're going to present and the degree to which that work would be representative of the audience that they're trying to reach. And so this doesn't specifically go to your point, but if you are somebody who makes grand opera and you say that your intended audience is preschoolers, maybe that's not going to be a quality arts experience. So in the application, you talk about your work, you talk about your experiences and what you're hoping to, how you're hoping to connect with an audience, and then those panelists, those individual citizens, help determine whether that's going to be a really strong quality arts experience or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your discretion. I may be misunderstood, but I think what I heard is that there are no parameters. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Heitzman. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Jens, for highlighting the work that you are and addressing some of the disparities that you're seeing with applications that are coming in. And so I have a question. You know, what are the requirements, if any, from the state's Arts Board and the Regional Council, and making sure that they are doing outreach and engagement with these underserved communities?
Director.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Representative Lee. We've had this conversation, and I'm happy to talk a little bit more about it. I'm really thrilled that about 3 months ago, we hired an outreach coordinator. We had not had that position before. That person has been with us just since the end of October, and she is working with me and with others on our staff to identify communities that we have not reached well, to explain the opportunities, to help them understand how to apply for a grant. And so moving forward, we're going to be doing more of that. We've relied primarily on email and other kind of traditional social media and other things, but our plan is to be much more directed about where we reach out, maybe do in-person things or other kinds of activities. So we are going to, we're mindful of that, and we intend to do a better job of reaching out.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Director Jens, what about the requirements for the Regional Arts Council? Are they required to, you know, conduct robust engagement like you mentioned that the Arts Board is doing, or are they free to conduct whatever type of engagement that they want?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, we don't require them to do that. We do strongly encourage them to really understand all of the needs in their region. And if there are places that are not being served, groups that are not being served, to think about how they might do that. But each region does that very differently. And I won't go into it because obviously we're getting quite short on time. But, you know, if you think about the second region, Region 2, which is that northern, there are three Native nations in that region. The needs there are probably very, very different than the needs of, say, the Rochester, Winona, and southeastern Minnesota. So each of the councils is charged with developing the best plans and the best services they can for the people that they serve.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions, everyone. My apologies. We never seem to have enough time to do as deep a dive as we'd like. But I know Director Jens and her teams are open to questions, and you have historically, and we're hoping you will be too. And thank you for the work that you're doing. I'm always fascinated by how many, especially when I get the printout of how many grants, like these small grants, and just how much programming we're able to do as a state. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Please be available for questions from members. So moving on to Minnesota Historical Society. Welcome. I think we're Director Whitworth. I believe you're starting off. Welcome to the Legacy Committee again, and please begin. How much money do you get, sir?
We'll get into that in the presentation. Okay. Chair Lilly, Vice Chair Hussein, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present a few highlights from the amazing work that has been accomplished by the Minnesota history community over the past year. My name is Kent Whitworth. I'm director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. To my left is my colleague David Kelleher, director of public policy and governmental relations at MNHS. And to my right is Avi Vishwanathan, who is our director of community engagement. And it's a delight to be with you this morning. We will be working off of this report that I think each of you have received in your packet. We do this annually. And the report is organized by the various programs for which the legislature appropriated funds in this biennium. We are very pleased to share the demonstrated impact of legacy appropriations from the past year. And you see these at-a-glance statistics. I encourage you to take a look at the return on investment and also the substantial distribution across the state of Minnesota. And then I want to also talk about the Minnesota History Coalition. This is a group of 13 statewide organizations, and it's our honor at MNHS to present information to you on behalf of not only MNHS but our partners. Let me also remind you, you can look through that list of 13 organizations, but those 13 organizations represent more than 400 individual organizations across our state that do history in Minnesota. And in addition to those organizations, there are countless individual scholars and volunteers that contribute to this work. And with that, I will hand off to my colleague, David Kelleher.
Welcome, Mr. Kelleher. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm David Kelleher with the Minnesota Historical Society. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we begin this conversation with on the legacy amendment with the words from the Minnesota Constitution. And the legacy amendment in the Constitution says that one of the purposes of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund is, quote, to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. We think it's pretty cool that the words to preserve Minnesota's history are in the Constitution, and we use that as our starting point. Following from there, you have made appropriations over the years for history activities. We follow that closely, and on this slide you can see how those appropriations have been structured over time. And we will take a moment to walk through how each of those areas works and what we've been able to accomplish with each of those. But briefly, we have a significant grants program for the organizations that Kent just mentioned. We have statewide programs that are operated by the Minnesota Historical Society. We have a category called statewide history partnerships, and those are partnerships of organizations that may include the Minnesota Historical Society, or they may be other organizations that work together. And then in addition, there is a statewide survey of archaeological and historic sites, and then an appropriation for the Minnesota Digital Library. Those categories are outlined with tabs in your report, and you can see a report on how we spent the dollars in each of those areas within that printed report. So we will very briefly go through each of the areas, and I will begin with a quick reminder. When Mr. Chair, you asked a minute ago how much funding is going into this area, this is the amount from the last biennium on this table, $15 million in the first year of the current biennium and $17 million, and then the breakdown for each of those five areas that are outlined in the report. Mr. Chair, I'll begin with the grants program. This is a statewide competitive grants program. Larger grants are reviewed by what we call the HRAC, the Historic Resources Advisory Committee. The structure of that committee was outlined and has been outlined in the legislation in the appropriations section of the history legacy bill. We have been able to do over 3,000 grants in all 87 counties over the life of the legacy amendment. These are grants for history programs, collections environments, and then preserving historic structures. We break those into two categories, large grants and small grants, with the small grants being under $10,000, and there's a different process for each of those categories, with the small grants being available more frequently, 3 to 4 times per year, and the large grants one time per year. Mr. Chair, the image that you just saw is an example of one grant. Again, thousands of grants. Each one has a story, and we could go on and on about each of the successes of those stories, but one that is just a great story. This is fire station number 24 in Minneapolis at 45th and Hiawatha. And if you were to drive by that building, it would be a nondescript industrial building right now. But the hidden history that is in that building has been uncovered and is extremely fun for us to work on. That was a fire station that was a segregated fire station with African-American firefighters that served that area. A group recently has worked to uncover that story and tell that story. They've gotten a lot of media. There was a story on Care 11, the captain of that story. There's some information about him. And again, there are just thousands and thousands of projects that have been carried out with these funds, and we can't tell them all. Mr. Chair, a couple more examples. The Wasioja recruiting station was a recruiting station for the Civil War just outside of Rochester, a small town. That's been preserved with legacy funds. And then the William Irvin up in Duluth, the ore boat that many of you probably have had a chance to visit. Just a quick word about the HRAC and their process. The Historic Resources Advisory Committee makes recommendations to the Minnesota Historical Society's governing board, the Executive Council, which has final approval over all grants, large and small. The HRAC membership is outlined in the appropriations language and covers a variety of different disciplines, archaeology, local history, historic preservation, and archival programs. The HRAC members are volunteers. They spend countless hours reviewing grant applications with the online system before they come to the HRAC meeting, and they spend 2 days each cycle reviewing grant applications. We have a paperless application system so that the HRAC members can easily review those and not have stacks and stacks of papers to review the grants. The HRAC members are extremely dedicated, and you saw in the previous picture when they have had a chance to meet together in person. During the pandemic, they met online. Here's a picture of one of the HRAC meetings. And they're really, really dedicated people who spend a lot of time helping us make these decisions. Final bullet point here is the Minnesota Historical Society Grants Office is here to help. The Grants Office staff does a monthly workshop, open house. Those were in person. They continue to do those online. And they break those up into topics of beginning, how to do your first grant, to more in-depth grant topics. So if any of you have projects that you're interested in getting funded, we can match you up with the grants office, and they can provide advice on how to move forward on that. This picture is in your booklet showing where the grants have gone around the state. As mentioned, 3,000 grants across the state to 924 different organizations, a total of $69 million since the start of the legacy amendment. And we are experiencing a lot of demand, over 2-to-1 in dollars available. So there's a lot of projects out there. Grant applicants sometimes will take a couple of tries, not because they don't have a great project, but just because there aren't a lot of dollars available. So with that, I'll turn it back to Kent.
Thank you, David. I'd like to provide a little context before Avi walks us through the statewide programs. Excuse me. Our statewide programs are operated by the Minnesota Historical Society, so I thought it would be helpful to take a quick look at the mission statement. You see it on the screen. This mission statement was refined in 2021 as part of our overall strategic planning process. And we are very committed to that opening statement. We serve all Minnesotans. And I'm pleased with this mission statement because it really answers the question why history matters. And you see toward the end of the statement the kind of environment we're trying to cultivate. We feel like curiosity is so important. We think a deep understanding, empathy, and good information in an inclusive kind of setting is sort of what our mission looks like fulfilled. And so I wanted you to have that context. I'd also like to touch briefly on the strategic imperatives. These are really the anchors of our strategic plan. We're about almost 2 years into it now. When we talk about transforming access, what we're really getting at is trying to attract new audiences while we serve existing audiences. This is about removing barriers to access MNHS content and programming. Re-envisioning space means both physical and virtual space. This really relates to collaborating and sharing knowledge with communities across the state, and together continuing to build cooperative advocacy networks to advance history and heritage preservation in Minnesota. When we talk about expanding expertise and authority, this is where we really are trying to kind of wear our commitment on our sleeve, if you will, to encourage a better understanding of how history is created. This imperative enables us to provide space, both online and in person, for real critical reflection on the way history informs contemporary issues and concerns. I like to say that a lot of times history has more to do with the present than it does the past, and this third imperative is what we're talking about. And when we talk about creating a sustainable future, certainly this means investing in our human resources, our outstanding workforce, paid and volunteer, creating meaningful change and equity and inclusion by establishing fair and sustainable market-based compensation for all of our staff. And so that's what a sustainable future looks like for us at MNHS. So with that, I'll hand off to our Director of Community Engagement, Avi.
Welcome, Director. I'm going to give it a shot here. Sorry. Welcome, Director Vishwanathan. I'm not very good at it. But please go ahead when you're ready, Director, and welcome to our committee. Please say your name. Give me another shot.
No, thank you, Chair Lilly. My name is Avi Vishwanathan, and I'm the director, as Kent said, Director of Community Engagement with the Minnesota Historical Society. And as we talk about statewide programs, one easy way of thinking about how we organize our activities is in preserving, sharing, and connecting. Preserving can mean a number of different things, but one piece that is really important to us is actually a relatively new part of our work is digitization. We've been working on projects to digitize newspapers. We have a hub on our website, a newspaper hub, where we have 5 million pages of Minnesota newspapers that are available to access. There's geographic breadth from the Aiken Independent to the Zumbrota News, and culturally specific and community specific newspapers, including the Minneapolis Spokesman Recorder, which has been a great opportunity to build relationships with them. Oral histories are another way of preserving history in our state, giving people the opportunity to share their history through their own voices. One of my favorite projects that's come from my department in the organization is an oral history project about Adney Lake in Crow Wing County, where a group of African Americans bought property along the shore of the lake to build cabins and create recreation space for themselves. In addition, there's cataloging, where we have our collections, our items that we keep and preserve within the History Center, with partnership with our archaeology team, things that people bring to us. It's one of the other ways that we preserve history. Sharing is an important way to reach across to Minnesotans, and through all of our sites, we have exhibits that tell different histories of the places within the state and communities within the state. I'm going to walk through a couple of examples for us right now. First, this is the First Avenue exhibit that was at the History Center that unfortunately, I think not a ton of people got to see due to a pandemic, but this is one example. Another example we have is the We Are Hmong exhibit that was also at the History Center. So we've had a series of culturally specific exhibits. So We Are Hmong, there's also the Somali exhibit that was at the History Center that actually created a longer-term relationship with the Somali Museum, who we continue to work with from that particular exhibit. We also have the Our Home Native Gallery in the History Center, which is another exhibit that was really created in partnership with Native communities. We Are Hmong in partnership with the Hmong community. I mentioned the Somali Museum. There was also a Beyond Bollywood exhibit a number of years ago that we continue to have relationships with the South Asian community in Minnesota. And so those exhibits that we just highlighted, here are some artifacts that were donated from Native communities or created by people within Native communities that are important to them, and that community partnership and relationship is really what made those possible, and being able to carry that forward from those exhibits into other areas of work is one of our key goals and pieces of what we do, as Kent mentioned, from our pieces of our strategic plan. Another example of an exhibit that, you know, across the state, we have Women of the Big Lake at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum, so highlighting women within the Native community there. We have an exhibit at the Split Rock Lighthouse that will be opening in the near future, so this applies across the state, and the engagement with those communities is important in each of those spaces. A third area of our work is connecting, and so I talked a little bit about the relationships that were built through those exhibits, and that that idea of connecting with those communities, having those communities be able to share their histories, is not just about them sharing with themselves or just with us, but it's about connecting other communities with each other. And in those spaces and in the exhibits, people get to learn about all Minnesotans and get an opportunity to learn about Minnesotans whose histories may not have been at the front and center of what we've all done or what we've learned. And that engagement aspect and what my department works on is such a key piece to how we are learning about each other and discovering with each other. And that's true of adults and children, and through K-12 education and curriculum support, different aspects of work that we want to create that affect the everyone from young to old. And part of that work is also creating access for people to the museum field. One of the programs that I am proudest of is the Native American University, we call it NAMF, Native American Undergraduate Museum Fellows, where Native Americans, undergrad students, participate in a fellowship program where they, as a cohort, learn about the museum field, about history, explore their own history, and have an internship within the Minnesota Historical Society to participate in some aspect of the work. A number of individuals from that program, we have nearly 100 people who've gone through that program over the course of its existence. We just had an alumni gathering this past weekend that was the first time that alumni had come together, and people are working all over the field. In addition to the Historical Society, we have a handful of alumni from that program who are working in the Community Engagement Department and at some sites across the field. We also have two other fellowship programs. One is the History Museum Fellowship, which is a little bit broader in terms of who's participated in that. That's been on hold during the pandemic, but we're looking to relaunch that. And the Adney Lake Oral History Project was actually came from an intern through that program. And we have Heritage Studies and Public History internship program in partnership with the University of Minnesota that also provides grad students who are studying public history an opportunity to intern with our organization. And then lastly, one other way that we share and connect people is through public programs. So different types of programming opportunities beyond physical exhibits where people can come learn about history, hopefully have conversations with each other. A couple of examples that we have here on the left, we're going to be screening a film called Invisible Warriors, which is about Black Rosie the Riveters, who worked at a munitions plant in the Twin Cities during World War II. And it was Black women predominantly working in that space. We've gotten a chance to speak with descendants who worked in that of people who worked in that plant, who are going to be present at that event during the screening. And we're going to hopefully be able to have an opportunity for people to speak to the filmmaker about that research. So that's part of what we when we talk about connecting, it's connecting deeply with people who are impacted by that history too. On the right, there is another program of Brown Buffalo Soldiers at historic Fort Snelling, where they were stationed. So that's another example of how we think about our programs broadly as it relates to all of our sites. And I believe I'm handing it back to David.
Mr. Chair.
That was really good, Director. Thank you. That was really thorough and very interesting to hear all those different programs. I particularly like that you're engaging students and creating interest. We've been trying to do that as a committee the last couple of years, and it sounds like you're really doing it, you know, to get people in outdoor jobs or in history jobs and get interested and perpetuate that in the future. Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, we'll finish up here in a moment. Yep. The third category that we'd like to discuss a little bit is history partnerships. This is a opportunity for history organizations to share resources, whether that's financial resources, their own expertise, and come together to do a history project that will be more successful based on their sharing of resources. As I mentioned, these partnerships can be with the Minnesota Historical Society and other organizations, or between other organizations. And there are a number of examples of those projects in your handout. One of them we'd like to highlight is a project, an organization that we've been working with for a number of years, Northern Bedrock Historic Preservation Corps,
that has young people come in and learn about historic preservation, learn about the trades while preserving buildings. This image is at the Halfway Ranger Station in Ely, and they have done a bunch of work on that structure itself, but then they fan out across the state, work with local organizations. Maybe they'll help repair a cemetery in a community and teach that community how to clean the headstones in the proper way or write them. And they work in teams. They camp on site. We did a site visit last year in Afton. They were doing a cemetery project in Afton, and they were camping in the cemetery. So I don't know if I'd want to do that. Mr. Chair, the statewide survey of historical and archaeological sites is a joint project with the State Office of the State Archaeologist, Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, State Historic Preservation Office, and Minnesota Historical Society. There are a handful of projects. Might be a survey of a geographical area or a theme, and that adds to the knowledge base that we all have moving forward to inform future activities, whether it's building projects or scholarship. You've got some images of projects that have been undertaken. This is a manual that will be produced on pottery in the future. Finally, Minnesota Digital Library is a collaboration between Minnesota Historical Society, Minitex, and other history partners, including local history organizations, and they have digitized all different kinds of collections, photos, maps, journals, letters, and a nice old map of Duluth, and then an image that's in their photo database of the Great Northern Machine Shop in Brainerd a number of years ago. So, Mr. Chair, we haven't talked a lot about budget, but our the History Coalition's request for the upcoming biennium is based on the November forecast, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit more in depth after the next forecast. And again, we thank you for the opportunity to discuss the work that we and our partners have been doing over the last year and 15 years, and appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you all for coming today. We're a little squished for time, but I had a great suggestion from Representative Heitzman that we take a journey across the street there and tour. So I hope committee members would be open to that, and I'm certain that you would open your doors. And hopefully people have been through some of your tours that you've done with great success, especially the Hmong display event. That was amazing, and the Somali events that you have were incredible, but just all the general good work you're doing. If you have, so we're kind of squished from times, but go ahead, Representative, you have a quick go ahead with a quick.
Thank you, Chair Lely, for giving me this moment. Thank you for all the great work that the Historical Society has done. I just want to touch on your mission here, where it says, we serve all the people of Minnesota by creating powerful engagement with the history of cultivated curiosity and foster more inclusive, empathetic, and informed society. You know, it's not by chance that there is a large group of diverse people sitting on this committee. It is because this work is important to our communities and all the communities across Minnesota. But we want to let you know that we want to work with you to ensure that this vision, this goal, is achieved for all Minnesotans. So thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Chow, we look forward to working with you to live into that mission. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming today, and certainly, like I said, I expect you to be open to questions. I know you have been historically and are up to that task, and so if members have questions, and then...
historically, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So next on the agenda, we have a presentation from the Humanities Center.
Thank you.
And welcome to our committee, and go ahead and get set up. Welcome, Mr. Lindsay and your team. Thank you very much for coming. Just want to express our I understand you recently had a loss in your father, and sorry for that. But thank you for coming, and again, sorry for your loss. Mr. Lindsay, you've been doing a great job with the Humanity Center, and so thank you for coming today. And you do a lot of work for us. You do your own work that you're going to tell us about, and then you help us with vetting some of the grant programs that we have going. And so go ahead, Mr. Lindsay, when you're ready, and can kind of tell your story. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lilly and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Lindsay. I spell my first name K-E-V-I-N for the record, and for the record, my last name is L-I-N-D-S-E-Y. Understanding the goals of the committee, I'm going to provide a brief overview of our respective work, how the MHC has historically used legacy funding and the value proposition for the Minnesota Humanities Council. So if we could begin a little bit about MHC itself, asking the questions of sort of like who is the Minnesota Humanities Center. First off, we are an affiliate organization to the federal agency known as the National Endowment for the Humanities. During this presentation, I'll sometimes refer to it as NEH. All 50 states have an NEH affiliate organization, and 4 of the 6 territories in the United States have an affiliate organization. Minnesota began serving as NEH's Minnesota affiliate back in 1971. NEH has been in existence for slightly more than 50 years. According to the NEH website, it says it serves and strengthens our democratic republic by promoting excellence in the humanities and conveying the history lessons of our country to all Americans. The humanities are defined in the dictionary as the academic disciplines that study the aspects of being human, such as art, language, religion, philosophy, political science, civics, jurisprudence, and history. Personally, I like to think of the humanities in this way. It's the stories that we tell ourselves and our family members to help us make understanding of what it means to be human, our communities, and our society. It's the stories we tell each other. So that's what we do. Again, legally, we're a Minnesota nonprofit organization. We have a board of directors similar to the state arts board. We do have members of the Humanities Council who are appointed by the governor. By federal law, that's limited to not being a majority of the respective members, and this is the same for all Humanities Councils across the nation. We accomplish our mission by providing humanities offerings that help people understand the various cultures and societies, philosophies of the world, and how our past impacts our current society. I was reminded by Chair Wentworth's comment of a quote by William Faulkner, history is not dead, it's not even past. So this idea of how we understand our present, it's really important that we understand our past. Our vision is a just society that is curious, connected, and compassionate. I like to think of the curiosity that we listen to one another with open hearts and open minds. Connectedness, as Dr. King reminds us, is that we see ourselves tied to a garment of mutuality, what impacts one impacts the other, and compassionate, that we're motivated beyond empathy toward action. We're located on the east side of St. Paul at 987 Ivy Avenue, the building depicted on your screen. Our historic building was once used as the school building for the old Children's Gillette Hospital complex, and we'd like to think and hope this will remain true, that it is the last place that a child was educated with the disease of polio. We like to think that we're proudly carrying on that tradition of being a place of healing and of learning. Let me briefly tell you about our event center. We operate an event center at 987 beyond just simply our offices. We have a small boardroom that serves 15 or fewer people for meetings. Library space holds up to 50 and approximately 90 people within our commons area. It's primarily used for nonprofit organizations, educational entities, and governmental entities. For example, the Task Force for Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women held its meetings within MHC. We've had conversations about housing-related issues, and then we've had a variety of different nonprofits use it for their vision of what democracy means for them. We're blessed to have a commercial kitchen and a small kitchen staff, a mighty kitchen staff, though, and they prepare outstanding breakfast, lunch, and dinner for our guests. Counting mornings and evenings as sort of separate opportunities to host an event. Pre-pandemic, we would host about 400 events. Again, that's counting morning and evening, so it stays very busy. We're also very fortunate and thank the legislature for providing us with bonding assistance to update our respective building. We have 15 hotel quality rooms, so people will also use our space for retreats. No TVs in the room. I said a retreat center, right? Last year, even though we were impacted by the vestiges of the pandemic, we hosted 228 events and we served a little more than 7,000 people. If we go to the next slide. As an organization, we're recognized by our peers and our partners for a deep collaborative style in working with individuals, scholars, educators, community organizations, and governmental entities. We like to think of ourselves as being radically nonpartisan. We do, however, to seek to raise the stories and the voices of communities that have often been ignored or silenced. Or accordingly, we actively seek out partners and communities to bring them together who might not have always been at the table together with one another. We're known for creating projects that are highly immersive. People roll up their sleeves, they get involved. You will be asked questions. There's no need to be shy here in Minnesota. We fully embrace the idea that the humanities provide helpful tools to innovate and make change. We like to think of our approach as being comprised of the three C's: convening people together, connecting people together, and then catalyzing their decisions arrived by the people that they have identified. In the past 3 years, we have been recognized with three awards that I want to share. The first is the Schwartz Prize, which is the top honor for given to humanities councils by the Federation of State Humanities Council. The Schwartz Prize was given to us for a project in which we partnered with Sweet Potato Comfort Pie and Rose McGee, who's a humanities officer. We utilize what Rose has done with these sweet potato pies, in which local leaders are then given those pies, and then they're able to turn around and give pies to people in the communities that are doing great things. And we thought after the death of Mr. George Floyd that it was really vitally important for a real honest conversation about how the African-American community could see itself, heal itself, and move forward within the democracy. So pies were given out in Mankato and Duluth and Rochester and St. Cloud, and we created an opportunity for a conversation, not just simply as to how deaths are occurring at the hands of police, but how deaths are occurring within the African-American community. How we can see ourselves and express ourselves through art and through the humanities. How we can see ourselves, young and old, old people like myself with more salt on their head, you know, can't complain because I still have hair, right? So to that extent, it was a wonderful event. We also had received an award, History in Progress, and this was a fantastic collaboration with the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial folks within Duluth, and then our own federal district courthouse led by Judge Jack Thunheim, who was the chief judge at that particular point in time. We had Richard Gergel, just a judge from South Carolina, talking about a historical case which led to the desegregation of the military within this presentation. And then I think there was a conversation about one of our fantastic scholars here, Duchess Harris. Her grandmother was one of the individuals within, I was going to say hidden. What was the last name? Hidden Figures, yeah. So this was the women who were serving as the calculators, which Senator John Glenn relied on more than even the supercomputers there at NASA at that particular point in time. She also was one of the individual presenters. It was a fantastic event. This is the top award given out by the American Association of State and History local organizations. We also received a Diversity and Inclusion Award given by Minnesota Lawyers for a similar project connected to that. And those awards have been happening in the last 3 years. The legacy funding that we received falls in one of two areas. The first area is for programs and purposes. My counterparts, who Jens mentioned, Arts Board does not create programs. We do create some programs with some of the funds that we receive, and that's what we use that first bucket for in that first area. The other is that we also provide grant making, and it kind of falls into, and it's dependent on the will of the legislature. Sometimes it's very specific and you identify by name. So in that middle bucket, civics programs, the legislature identified specifically the programs that we were to give money to. In the area of cultural heritage grants, you asked us to create an application process for, and then we did the marketing, we did the outreach within that respective area. The area for Children's Museum was kind of a hybrid in that you identified two museums that you wish to give funding to, and then ask for the remaining balance of about $550,000 to be an open competitive process. So again, this does vary every biennium. If we go to the next slide. Our legacy programs and purposes, it falls across four broad areas. The first is education. The second is civic renewal. The third is immersive. And the fourth is statewide. Since we're pressed for time, I'll go to the next slide and talk a little bit more about education. The picture there with the kids standing in front of me with masks on. If you ever go into a school building with Justice Page, just know that sometimes kids might ask you to do push-ups as well. I don't know why they thought I was a Viking at some point in time. But it was a great experience. We had an opportunity to read our Native American book series. I didn't pass out doing my push-ups. I was very proud about that. So the individual teachers there walking along the path, they're getting some education about the Bedote field trip. This is where we identified three spots within Ramsey County of significance to the Dakota people. So this was a great workshop for them. We use that retreat center for education opportunities. Most recently, some school districts have been asking us, can they work with paraprofessionals, sort of growing their own talent to meet the incoming teacher shortage? If we go to the next slide, please. Civic renewal, again, with malice toward none, is a great example of sort of our nonpartisan effort in which, obviously, there's no people who actually are red and blue, right? But to this extent of people with different political views getting to the table to see how we can discuss moving forward within the democracy, we were very happy to host that respective event. And I know from some of the folks within the community, they were surprised that I would make space for some folks that might be of different political views. Imagine that, radical, that you could actually have different political views and could talk to one another across the table. The governor is there with our poet laureate. By statute, we're responsible for helping the governor identify the poet laureate. And then there have been other events in which we seek to provide more opportunities for people to talk about civics. Debating democracy now, then and now is an example of that. We're doing a project with Third Way Civics, leveraging opportunities, again, of how we can talk across political divides within colleges as well as in high schools. If we go to the next slide, please. Immersive programming. The Native American Book Series, that also won awards for the last 3 years for its reach. We try and see ourselves as filling a small niche within the book publishing market. It's a very difficult market to sometimes get diverse voices in. But what we're finding is that there are a lot of schools that really would appreciate having more diverse books to be able to broaden the outreach that they have with the students. So here is some of those books that we have tried to meet that respective need. We also provide opportunities for people to find out about the rich tapestry and the various different cultures within our state, within the immersive space. If we go to the next slide, please. Statewide impact. Let me say here within the space, we have David Muir on the end there. The gentleman that is, seems to be writing there right next to David on your far right is someone which was captured within his book, which then was made into a short one-hour documentary on TPT. And this was about individuals who were interned at Fort Snelling and that utilized that time period to uplift their voices during World War II, and then also individuals of Japanese ancestry that were also in the Army at that point in time. So why did I tell you that? The Minnesota Humanities Center, in comparison to other humanities centers, is a leader for its respective work in the area of veterans. We appreciate the legislature's historical support within that. We seek to tell the stories not just of veterans, but of their loved ones, of refugees, and then from an academic lens, the cost as relates to war itself. If we go to the next slide. Legislatively named grantees, to give you a quick picture, I only did the last biennium as it relates to the grants. I did get a chance to see how grants had been made in the past at the Minnesota Humanities Center. I like the idea from the Historical Society, so I'm just going to say I'm going to do that the next time. My predecessor, Cheryl Dixon, loved this idea of giving small grants less than $500 to every county. So you'll see something like that coming forward from us. But within the last 2 years, you will see a broad swath of projects all throughout the state of Minnesota from the funds that we have received, and we thank you on behalf of the folks that are grantees within that space. We go to the next slide. So cultural heritage grants within this space. And this is consistent with the respective language to reach out to BIPOC communities. Again, very similar to what you heard from my counterparts at the Historical Society and also the State Arts Board. You'll see a slight difference in the number of awards being given, and that's really tied to the percentage of applications in the overall pool. The groups that had fewer or smaller numbers, there's actually a disproportionate positive to those groups. So again, for example, for the Latino group, there's actually more than 11% of the applications within that space. The amount awarded there, 107 awardees for the $4.75 million. The request there is over $7 million. I would say that had we had more money, we easily could have given six or seven within that space. If we go to the next slide. Disproportionate impact for smaller organizations and individuals. Again, we have heard from folks when I got a chance with KCD Murray, who's here at the table with me when we have done tours of the state. How can the Humanities Center reach out and meet the needs of individuals and organizations that sometimes are overlooked by foundations across the state? So we have been really intentional in reaching out to smaller organizations. If we go to the next slide. This testimonial here, I think, is really illustrative of sort of what we're trying to accomplish. And that is these following four. Fund cultural work by BIPOC organizations that's often overlooked and undervalued by traditional grant makers. Having a grant-making process that's simple, accessible, and responsive. There should be no debate on this. We as government and we as quasi-government, we within the foundation should try to make things simple and accessible and quick for folks, and we really take that to heart. We want to be customer-friendly, customer service, be prompt with our feedback, and I really appreciate Casey's efforts within that spot. And while there is oversight from an administrative standpoint, we really seek not to be burdensome within that. So. We have fantastic programs that we can identify, but what I'm going to do because of time, I will send you some of the ones that are very interesting to me. They're all, it's hard to pick among your children, but we'll try to pick some to share with you. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. Hey, I know you're doing a great job, and thank you for doing so much good work. Any questions, Representative Cha?
Thank you, Chair Lilly. I just want to comment and commend you, Lindsay, for your leadership and transparency in the grant-making process and to be a leader in this difficult space. So I must commend you. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Representative Chair and member, Chair and Representative. Appreciate you for your comments. Thank you.
Vice Chair Hussein.
Thank you, Kevin Lindsay, and sorry about the loss of your dad. And I want to thank you for collaborating individuals, organizations, communities, and the great work that you are doing. We appreciate it, and I look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. Thank you very much for your presentation and for all of the work you do. Also, we didn't have a chance with the Minnesota Historical Society, both of your work have been very important to me in my professional work in the past, and I just want to you know, state my intention to ensure that we are adding to our cultural work the preservation and the history and the creation of work in the queer community, and making sure that Minnesota's rich and diverse history of and very important history in the gay rights movement and in the queer space, both pre and post Stonewall, is having a central part of this conversation. So I know that that work is important to both of your organizations. It's not a an accusation to the other, but I want to make sure it's tentpoled and we're having those conversations very clearly. So looking forward to creating that space with you.
Representative, I appreciate the comment. And sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative Finke, I appreciate the comment, and I know within a democracy it's really important to have one's voice heard, so I really appreciate you having your voice heard.
Thank you. Representative Straba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindsay, I want to thank you for all your comments. You leave me with I completely trust you. I really, your quotes in the beginning with Dr. Martin Luther King, and then you're radically nonpartisan. I feel that with you. I sense it with you. You're fair. I look forward to working with you, and I think you're doing a great job, what I've seen. And I wish we had more time, but thank you again.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate those comments.
Representative Hurd.
Chair Lilly, this is just maybe a more question for our committee, is that I've had the opportunity to serve on the Education Committee and now Legacy for the first time, and I see so much overlap. Like, I had no idea, when I go to one of these, I have no idea if it's the Humanities or if it's a History Center, who it is, because I've seen actually many of these exhibits, the Hmong, the Somali, the First Avenue one, I have pictures. I think you had a 50s display once, and actually my children's first Hmong books was this show in Northern Lights, and I came to an event there with the author. And so before I came into this work, I had no idea who gets money for what. And I wonder if there are ways in which, and maybe we can have a deeper discussion at a time or when I come in to visit, but really pairing what we're doing with education, because we're asking for ethnic studies, we're asking for greater cultural competency in the curriculum in schools, and they keep telling us it's unfunded mandates. But we're already having such amazing work and education here in this space and in the arts, and what are ways in which we can do a better job instead of solving problems within each of our silos and our committees to say, how do we then build a synergy in each other's work? And I would love to have that conversation maybe as a group or with, you know, the organizations here so that we can be more efficient in what we're trying to do. So I just want to maybe put that out there for us to figure out how to be innovative and in how we work in this committee.
Thank you, Representative Hurd. There is so much overlap in many of our funds, and you know, Chair Lee, we've tried to visit and try to strategize a little bit on some of the work that he's doing and the Environment Committee is doing and with this committee, but certainly we're up to the, we need to raise the bar in other areas as well. So thank you for that challenge. Thank you, Director, for coming. Really appreciate your work. You can answer on after the fact. I'm just wondering how you're, like, because you're doing all these grants for us, I just want to make sure we're making you whole. So just please tell our committee if, you know, if there's enough overhead, you know, how that, because we're probably going to up more work through your you know, getting closer to that $7 million or even beyond that, maybe in particular in the cultural grants, and so we want to make sure that you're able to continue to do the good work with your staff.
Well, Chair Lilly and members of the committee, what I have heard during my time as a leader of the Minnesota Humanities Center is that these grants make a powerful impact within communities. You mentioned Dr. King. I was down in Rochester for the Dr. King celebration there. We did an event, the Convenium, which is a fancy word for a conversation, right, in Fergus Falls, talking about a variety of different issues which were there. And what I can tell you is there is a lot of connection if there is opportunity and space to be made available for people to reach out. And we're very happy and proud to be able to play a small part within that space. So I appreciate the committee thinking in this way. Please don't think that you're overburdening us. This is the work that we are excited to do.
Thank you, Director Lindsay, and thank you to the Arts Board folks that came today and the Historical Society folks. And thank you for a good meeting and questions. And as I know, you're all open to further questions from members. So with that, we are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.